radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
For professional sharps protection in all extrications, visit extricationwrap.com. Protecto Wrap Company's Extrication Wrap protects rescue professionals from sharp metal edges, broken glass, sharp plastic, and other wreckage hazards. The Extrication Wrap's easy peel and stick application saves time and lives, allowing clear, safe access for extricating victims. For more information, visit extricationwrap.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Bob Dumel, your host for The Buzz on Technical Rescue. Our topic for today is Ron's top 10 list of vehicle rescue challenges of 2010. My guest today is Ron Moore. Ron currently is the training chief with the McKinney, Texas Fire Department. He's the author of University of Extrication series and is featured each month in Firehouse Magazine. Ron's conducted training seminars at all levels on automobile rescue, bus rescue, and continues to promote and educate the fire service community on advancements in the automobile industry. Ron, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome, Bob. No problem.
During today's session, as I said, we're going to talk a little bit about Ron's top 10 list and go into each one of these points a little bit more in depth and get some good background from somebody who's been one of the leaders in the field of extrication for a number of years in the fire service, has brought a lot of good knowledge to us and helped a lot of people become both safer and better at the tasks that they've taken on. To get us started, Ron, kind of explain what motivated you to put this top 10 list together.
What I wanted to say is if you need information and you can only spend so much time getting it, what would be the 10 most important bits of information that you should get to keep yourself up to speed on extrication? So it's just, if we're going to spend time training in extrication, let's make sure we're looking at least these 10 hot buttons that are current within the industry. Whether you know about them or not, they're challenges that we need to be able to be aware of and then to address.
Excellent. And there again, you're putting them in a manageable bite, so somebody's going to really gain knowledge out of it and walk away with some improved level of function. We'll get right into it, starting with our first one, extrication PPE. What did that bullet point represent when you put it on paper?
I still am perplexed why extrication people can't have protective clothing, protective equipment that protects us, but yet allows us to do our job without being hindered. Fire departments require rescuers to wear structural gloves that are fine for firefighting and meet all the national standards for firefighting. We typically find out structural gloves for extrication are too bulky. Well, then you have the manufacturers that come out with the extrication gloves, and you find that those are so lightweight and thin, particularly on the sides of the fingers, that the extrication gloves don't prevent you from being cut with sharp metal or sharp glass. You put helmets with the Bork-style eye shields or even the full flip-down face shield, and those aren't adequate eye protection. Finally, we're seeing the helmet manufacturers come up with the kind of under-the-helmet goggle system, finally trying to address flip-down eye shields that will protect our eyes. Then they sell you safety glasses or goggles that you wear on your helmet and you put on during extrication work. Well, the first thing I see that the rescuers complain about is the safety glasses, or particularly the goggles, will fog up. So that's a challenge if you can't see what you're doing. And then it really is disturbing to explain to a fire department that at a highway incident, we're now required to wear high visibility clothing out on the highway, except if we're doing firefighting or hazmat. And our state-of-the-art, brand-new NFPA-compliant turnout gear doesn't count as high-visibility clothing. So PPE for extrication that essentially isn't exactly where it should be is, to me, the number 10. It's where to start. We're going to count down. It's number 10 on my list.
I think you had some good points there. And coming from the technical rescue field, too, we've seen a need to advance our specialization in PPE to where you literally have to carry that little ditty bag with multiple styles of glove. The glove I use on my extrication call isn't the glove I want to use when I'm doing high-angle rope work because of the products from the vehicles, the hydraulic fluids, the shards of glass and metal. So you really hit on a great point there. It's we've become a very advanced and specialized service to the community, but we also need to make sure we're advancing our equipment for our members' benefit. I think that's a great starting starting point. Moving into number nine, rescue jet lag. We talked a little bit prior. What are we training on compared to what are we responding to? Why don't you take it from here, Ron?
I coined the phrase rescue jet lag. It plagues instructors. And when you, as a training officer in your department, get a donated vehicle, it could easily be 10 years old, if not 12 or 15 years old. And at many vehicle rescue training sessions, the junk cars that we cut up may actually be as old as the firefighters that are cutting them up themselves. And the reality is the techniques that we're taught and that we practice on old cars, 10, 12 years old, and particularly non-damaged, non-crash damaged cars, may in fact not be the ones that work in the real world on the 2010s and soon to be the 2011s. So I coined the term jet lag, and I actually have a program where I tell instructors, given older vehicles, how they can, for pretend, make this 10-year-old car into a new car. One of the things I do is I'll take a black magic marker and I'll write on the door panel, draw a rectangle and put SRS to pretend the car has door airbags. Or I'll write SRS with a little oval on the seat to pretend the car has seat airbags. I'll spray paint the side roof rail or spray paint the B pillar of the car with bright orange or bright yellow paint to pretend it's got some of the new steels in it. So there's ways you can update it. But the problem is if the fire department's train on old cars and think those old car techniques are going to work today, they are truly in a rescue jet lag situation.
Okay. And with that, it's like many of the challenges we face is keeping up with the changes moving into the future. Vehicles are very expensive and accessibility to them is definitely one of the toughest challenges for our folks that are doing training specifically. Number eight, sources of information.
I don't think we do a good job as an industry, fire rescue industry, of accumulating at one spot places that I could go as an extrication trainer or as an extrication person and try to keep up to date with stuff. The automakers have information here and there. There's websites here and there. I don't think we have a consolidated way to go for good, reliable information. And then to network, I think there's a need to improve the way we share the information, stories that you have, lessons that you learned, case studies that you've been to. So I'm seeing some light at the end of the tunnel, but I think trying to get some reliable, consolidated, and consistent sources of information are very important and a challenge for us today.
And I think one of the things you've taken the lead in doing yourself is situations such as putting together the University of Extrication, your series in Firehouse Magazine. I know many firehouses, my own included, where people take these segments, pull them out of the book, and create little mini binders so that they have this at their fingertips. There's so many differences between manufacturers. Then you get into models per manufacturer, and for us to have a roadshow of knowledge with Hazmat, we come out with large support vehicles with major resource centers in them, both electronically and hard copy. For extrication, it's very difficult. Many times, a rescue company, a first-in company, whichever format a community uses, they don't know what the car is until they roll up on scene, so we don't have that luxury of advanced practice on the way as far as what will this model require, because we don't have that information until we arrive. So the more the industry can do, folks like yourself who've taken the lead to put this information together, at least on the backside of the operation in the firehouse, we're giving our people a real good fighting chance to be successful.
Yeah, and
I
think we're always somewhat behind the curve. I think it's unfortunate that fire departments find out about new technology on vehicles when the car's in the showroom. Because if it's in the showroom, it's been sold or others have been sold, and it's out there today. So I think we need a better way of working together as an industry and sharing and gathering and disseminating information on the advances in the extrication field.
I think that's going to be one of our long-term challenges, but I do see more and more coming out. It's putting it all together and then having folks such as yourself advocating for us, speaking to the industry experts and maybe enlightening them to the importance of that after the sale type of knowledge that our part of the world really requires. And I think it's a win-win for everybody in that situation. Move on to number seven, our vehicle stabilization. This is twofold. It's for our safety. And when we're looking at the big picture, an unstable vehicle obviously not only presents an issue for those who may be trapped in it, but a very hazardous position for those of us that are responding. What areas did you have set up in the stabilization component of your list? That
two things for stabilization, two issues that I would bring to any rescuers, particularly fire rescue officers' attention. If you have a vehicle sitting on four wheels on level surface and there's air in the tires, if you're going to commit extrication equipment to that car, it should be chocked and blocked, and then the tires should be deflated. You should have let the air out of the tires, however you do it, to allow the weight of the vehicle and the structure of the vehicle to settle onto the cribbing that you've established. If you don't, if you just chock and block a car and then you do extrication, think about it. As you take the door off, a door can weigh 50 pounds. As you take a window is 8 pounds. The windshield's 10 pounds. You remove the roof, it could be as much as 70 pounds. The car undergoes what I call extrication weight loss. It'll actually start floating. It'll come off of the cribbing and be less stable because you left the suspension system active. So the first point I make on stabilization is if you're committing extrication tools to the vehicle, chock it, block it, and blow it. Take the air out of the tires. And the second issue, in my opinion, is it is not practical today for a fire department to be considered in the vehicle rescue business without having some sort of strut stabilization system. I don't care what brand you use, but it is an essential element, just like cribbing is an essential element for stabilization. Have the capability of using tensioned buttressed stabilization strut systems, whatever brand. That is, in my opinion, a fundamental element to be able to say we're in the vehicle extrication business.
And I think that's key, and we see it in the advancements of the technologies that are available to us. The manufacturers of rescue equipment, over probably the last 5 years, have really moved forward in a major fashion in what's available to the local fire departments. And as you said, it doesn't matter what brand you're buying. What matters is that you've been exposed to, reached out, invested the money into it, because there again, it goes back to, by properly stabilizing these vehicles, we're creating the safest possible working environment for our folks. There's constant changes in an incident. It's a very dynamic world we work in the rescue service. So everything we can do to help enhance our safety profile, we're giving back to our folks what they deserve. And that's the opportunity.
And your patient, too. Your patient's going to benefit from a stable. So it's hard to find a fire department today that has not responded to a recent wreck with a car either on its side or on its roof, more so than ever before. So okay, accept that reality and have the equipment and the training to stabilize side resting or roof resting and go from there.
Sounds like a very good, you know, step into the future for our folks. Number six, airbag systems.
In my countdown, number six used to be number one. Airbags used to be the big challenge. It was all we could do to keep up with airbags back when there was three airbags, four airbags. And now there could be over 20 different locations and or styles of airbags that can be in a vehicle. They just came out with airbags in the seat belt, the shoulder harness, airbags that go between the two rear seat passengers that come down from the roof. So the stored gas inflators, airbags in the roof with the stored gas inflators, and how that affects extrication. We have to really be aware, and I would recommend going to car dealerships and taking a look at some of the new vehicles and look at where are the airbags in the vehicle. It's no longer a question when you arrive at a crash, does this car have airbags? The question anymore is, where are the airbags this time? And it's the undeployed ones that are going to be the biggest challenge for you. We had the 1997 incident in Dayton with the firefighters actually struck and ironically captured on video. So we know it can happen. We have airbags that can deploy, frontal airbags that can deploy, and when you arrive on the scene, there could be a live second charge in that airbag, the two-stage. We have the smart seat that shuts off the airbag if the passenger seat's empty. So you have more of a reality of having airbags undeployed right in your work area. Roof airbags. If a roof airbag's already deployed, the airbag itself is in the way to obstruct your access to your patient. And the stored gas inflator, 4,000 PSI up to 10,000 PSI for a roof-mounted airbag. Kia Sedona, which is a big minivan from Kia, actually has a stored gas inflator on the D pillar and one on the A pillar flowing into the same airbag. There's also vehicles that have the stored gas inflator right at the base of the A pillar, right exactly where we would make our cut for any type of roof opening or roof removal. There's about 14 possible locations for these stored gas inflators. And what I would recommend to fire departments to address that challenge is make sure you strip the trim. Make sure you know where your inflators are before you make any cuts in any roof structure. Knee bags, extra airbags in the seats. Honda's coming out with the pedestrian airbag. It's going to, when you run into somebody, it's going to jack the hood and fire an airbag up your windshield. So by the time they fly over the hood, they're going to land on this airbag. We're going to have airbags in the engine compartment, literally, when that comes about. So keeping up to date with the advances in the supplemental restraint, the airbags, is a constant, ongoing challenge.
And you referred to the video that was out of the individual at a scene where the airbag was deployed. It proves this is reality. This isn't classroom concept or theory or a scared straight type of situation.
It's not a hoax.
This is very true. This is happening, and that one happened to be captured on a video camera. If you got a group of people together who have a background in extrication, there would probably be more stories just like that. So the knowledge of them, and it goes back to your rescue jet lag. Everything's tying into each other. The deeper we go, we see how everything crosses from one to the other. And we're training on vehicles that may have one or two airbags. If you're unfortunate enough to have an extremely old vehicle, you may not even have an airbag in it. So we constantly have to keep our educational curve moving forward. As we continue through the list, number five, VSDS, our vehicle safety data systems, something you put together patterned after the MSDSs we have in the chemical world. What is this going to help for our folks as far as knowledge?
In 1998, one of my University of Extrication articles was the vehicle safety data sheet concept, the VSDS. And what I wanted and still want, but I'm actually making some inroads. I want the ability for a rescuer to arrive on scene and have information on the vehicle that tells you, for example, where's the battery? Where is the airbag stored gas inflators? Where is anything that is need to know? So what I thought should happen or could happen is if you look at the sun visor on all new vehicles, by federal regulations, the particularly the driver's sun visor, has to have a white and yellow label, black ink, telling you about don't put a kid in the car seat, drive with your seatbelt on, yada, yada. And I thought, you know, right next to that on the driver's sun visor and then one under the hood, we could have a little piece of artwork that I'm calling the VSDS. And it would be line art on the sun visor and under the hood of every car, and it would be just a line drawing of the car looking, let's say, down from the top, and it would show you where all the critical need-to-know things are on the vehicle. No technology. I don't need computers, scanners, or anything. It's actually a label put on the vehicle itself by the manufacturer, particularly for us, for our safety as we arrive at scene. It would make our operation so much more efficient if we could get mandate to the auto manufacturers to have a vehicle safety data sheet sticker two places under the hood and on the driver's sun visor on every vehicle built today.
Yeah, I think that's a great tool because we talk about our sources of information. There again, tying everything back to one another. We come upon these vehicles and I'm not sure if the industry varies from one type of vehicle to the other, but for years we've seen on school buses, battery compartment, certain high-profile locations are clearly labeled in certain types of vehicles. Usually our trucks are larger vehicles. So this is kind of taking something that's there in a partial form and advancing it to the masses. And when we look at the numbers of responses we go to, statistically, we're going to a lot more car accidents than we are bus and or truck accidents. So not that either side deserves better care than the other, but our high profile, our high volume customer, the automobile, is the one we have the least knowledge on.
Yeah, and where's the battery? That alone is a major challenge. Well, you flip the sun visor down, and there's, it's in the front fender well, it's in the rear trunk, it's under the back seat. How critical, how much of a difference would that make if the manufacturer would just put that label there in the first place? So Ron's 1998 VSDS is still alive and well. I'm still pushing it. It'll happen.
Well, this is one of those, hopefully perseverance will be your exactly. strongest ally in this, and that eventually, and if not sooner than later, this is accepted and becomes an industry standard. And we all look at certain things we do during our professional careers and the offerings we've made. This is the type of item where when you walk away at the end of your years of service to the community would be very enjoyable to look back on and say, well, boy, it was all worth it. Look at that. Every time I flipped the visor down, there it is. Definitely something to aspire to. Number four, our gasoline electric hybrids. The day of just a pure basic put the gas in, drive around vehicle is changing rapidly. We even have more we'll be coming upon shortly thereafter in your list here. On the gasoline electric hybrids, kind of tell us what the focus of number four is.
Well, there's a couple of things that have happened on the gasoline electric hybrids, the Prius, the Honda, the Ford, the Yukons, the Sierras. I mean, they're so numerous. There's even gasoline electric vehicles that are we don't even think of as passenger vehicles. There are diesel electric now in city buses, diesel electric in school buses as well. So it's left just the passenger car market. Kind of the hot buttons on the hybrids that the guys are asking about and needing to know is, first of all, one of the biggest challenges will be even identifying the vehicle you're working on as a hybrid. You have to, I don't know if rescuers know this, Bob, but you have to realize the badging, what's called badging, which is the labels that are around the outside of a vehicle that identify it as a hybrid, are not required by law. They are simply advertising. The only industry standard, just by chance, is the rear, either trunk lid or hatchback lid, the rear area of every hybrid made today through 2010 has at least one indicator in some manner of it being a hybrid. What I would like to see is three-sided, which many of the manufacturers do, where there's on the front door or front fender on the driver's side, front door or front fender on the passenger side, and at the rear. Give us three ways of badging so we can even identify that the vehicle we're working on is a hybrid and when we arrive on scene. The other thing that's important, I used to be able to say all high voltage cables on a hybrid are orange. In 2006, that changed. All I can say now is about the colors of cable, the high voltage cables. All orange cables on a hybrid are high voltage. Not all high voltage cables on a hybrid are orange. They can be orange if they're more than 60 volt DC. They can be yellow if they're 31 to 60 volt. And you may find, you may raise the hood on a vehicle, Saturn View, Saturn Aura, a vehicle. Those are hybrids from GM, where you raise the hood and you're going to see large diameter blue cable carrying the low voltage, less than 30 volt. So not all high voltage cables are orange anymore. Look for blue, look for yellow, or obviously look for orange. The high voltage cables are like coax cable. They all have a core that carries the power that's wrapped in plastic. Then they have a steel mesh around it, kind of like coax or like Kern mantle for those of you guys that are into rope rescue. So the technology of the computer system on the hybrids monitors the continuity of that wrap around that steel mesh. And if that gets broken or damaged, that's what actually can shut down the power during a crash. I had Honda donate two Honda hybrids back in 2003. And what I found was I did 53 out of 54 extrication tasks. We chopped these two cars apart, mimicking what I would have had to do at a real-world collision, with the only problem being the battery on the Honda Civic hybrids they were, is vertical right behind the back seat, and we couldn't do the one task called trunk tunneling. Fortunately, all these high-voltage cables run from typically a battery at the rear of the hybrid under the vehicle and come up into the front engine compartment area where the electric drive motors are. So it's not with proper training on the 7-step process of how to shut this system down, you can actually take a sophisticated vehicle and make it pretty routine and be able to accomplish your task. Learn about the smart keys that are very popular on the hybrids. The key that basically there is no ignition. It's just a push button on the dash. You should talk to your Toyota, your Honda, your Ford, or your GM, Chevy dealership and find out how does your smart key work on your particular hybrid vehicle. So the hybrids are still there. They're getting more and more common, more and more popular across the country, and we just need to be at the top of our game knowing how to deal with them after a crash and or after a fire situation.
You know, and hitting on your badging comment earlier, getting the three sides labeled, really an eye-opener for me as a responder. We do see these markings, but we make an assumption that they're there for our benefit or for a purpose, where, as you well hit on, it's just marketing. They're showing off that they have the latest and greatest.
It's advertising.
Advertising. There you go. And I think taking it a step further, shooting to have a three-sided mandatory format, also maybe having a standardized location for these so that the emergency responder, every vehicle is going to differ slightly because of design and characteristics, but if it's always going to be on the upper front driver door or the front fender.
Yeah, give me three chances to see it.
Yeah,
right now, if you put it on the rear and the cars are in rear-end collision, you took away my only chance.
Exactly.
I might not know I'm dealing with a hybrid until I get deep inside and find something. So it could be better.
Yeah, and the fact that it's being addressed and it's being mentioned and pushed out into the eyes of others, hopefully they'll do the right thing and listen so that we can work in a safer environment.
For professional sharps protection and all extrications, visit extricationwrap.com. Protecto Wrap Company's Extrication Wrap protects rescue professionals from sharp metal edges, broken glass, sharp plastic, and other wreckage hazards. The Extrication Wrap's easy peel and stick application also makes it a valuable tool for safe glass removal. Keep a roll of Protecto Extrication Wrap on your truck. Visit us at extricationwrap.com.
Welcome back to The Buzz on Technical Rescue. My guest this month is Ron Moore. Ron just recently presented a great educational webcast on firehouse.com last month. You can view this presentation, The Fundamentals of Extrication, NFPA 1670 operations level, by going online and visiting firehouse.com/webcast. Getting back to our show today, moving along in our countdown, number three, safe parking. This is where, we're talking about what we can do to protect ourselves at an incident that's already taken place.
Well, one of the interesting things about this highway safety, we still have firefighters and EMS people, police officers, tow truck operators struck and killed while working in or near moving traffic. That's still a reality. In an average year, there's 15 million vehicle crashes. And in an average year, about 9 million of them never get reported to cops or anybody. They happen. But in an average year, there's over 4 million property damage collisions, and typically 1.9 million collisions a year that involve injury. So I thought, how could I make 1,900,000+ How could I make that make sense to a firefighter as far as their safety? What it boils down to is there's, on average, 3 injury crashes occur in the United States every minute, 24/7. That's what 1,915,000 crashes a year equates to. So what difference does that make to me? Well, here's the deal. If you have two police officers go to every injury crash in your community, and at least four firefighters and two more people on an ambulance, and you send a tow truck, for every one of those three injury crashes that occurred this last minute that we've been together, nine responders, it turned out, and there's three of those accidents every minute. There's 27 responders every minute turning out to an environment that is at, they are at great risk where they're asked to work in or near moving traffic. 27 new responders turning out every minute, 24/7. And the motoring public, we describe them as the D drivers. Who is it that is killing us? Who is it that's not respecting the move over laws? It's the D driver, capital letter D. It's the drunk, the drugged, the drowsy, the distracted, or the just plain dumb. And they've now done official studies. National Safety Council came out with one just recently. They've done studies across the country that talk about cell phone use while driving is the equivalent of driving impaired. Texting while driving is the equivalent of driving blindfolded because you're looking down and you're driving forward. So our risk as police, fire, EMS, tow operator, our risk is great. Your department should have a plan to develop procedures for working in or near moving traffic. And again, respondersafety.com from the Emergency Responder Safety Institute, Cumberland Valley. Respondersafety.com is a great resource site. If departments need this information, it's out there. We need to come up with a plan for things like blocking, dealing with our safety. Before we can even use our extrication skills, before we can even use our vehicle firefighting skills, we should at least be able to properly have high visibility clothing, properly position our vehicles, have the chevrons on the apparatus, know how to set traffic cones that are compliant, be using the NFPA required high retroreflective fluorescent pink signs. We need to ramp up our game. You better, if you're, here's my deal in my department in McKinney, if it's feet on the street, vest on your chest. The high visibility vest is now required by the MUTCD, federal regulations with the in 2009. So we need to have our personnel protected if they're going to be working at the scene of an incident. Before they can even use any of their other skills, we need to have our own safety. So to me, it made number three on the list.
And when you start putting the numbers together of how many accidents, how often they're happening, and then make it more realistic how many of us are out in the street dealing with these accidents, it's a game of odds. The percentages are in our favor for something bad to happen, unfortunately. And I think you mentioned fire, EMS, law enforcement, and our tow operators. There's four separate agencies, all with their own mission. Another area where I think we need to improve in some parts, every once in a while, you'll open up a website, you'll go to firehouse.com, and you'll read an article about the fire officer who was arrested by the local law enforcement agency because of hindering the flow of traffic. Mm-hmm. We all have a mission. We understand that. Everybody, you know, has job one. But by getting together early in our learning curve prior to the accident, I guess I'd like to say, and in communicating why we're putting this extremely large aerial apparatus or a pumper or squad vehicle diagonally across the highway. Very seldom are things caught on tape. I remember a few years back when I was assigned to our rescue company, we were working in interstate through our city, heard a horrific crash, and it was a taxi cab that had rear-ended the last vehicle in line because people are one of your list of D's was probably distracted, or you have the opposite lane incident because of the rubbernecking factor. Traffic is slowed down.
Distracted again.
So communication with each other, I think, is a key element, too, so that when we're out there, we understand the value of each other's position.
Yeah, there are some good programs out there. Responder Safety has a lot of model SOPs on vests, on blocking. There are some good programs. VFIS has a good program for their customers on highway safety. So there's no excuse for a fire department not to be able to address that my number three challenge, safety while working in or near moving traffic. It's a reality.
Mm-hmm. And what we'll do, too, is for our listeners' benefit, we'll put the links to these various websites on the introduction page within the radio@firehouse.com component of the site so that you can, you know, have access to these and a good reference to, you know, put it in your favorites list. Take one of these, look at it, and use the tools that Ron's talked to us. As we get closer to the number one, number two, fuel cell vehicles and plug-in electric vehicles. These are becoming very popular. The technology is advancing. I think one of the biggest things we see is affordability has become much more realistic. So the cheaper or the more accessible a vehicle becomes, the more of them we're going to see on the road.
I also think, to me, this is number two on my list. We're counting down, and this is number two. We need to, as Fire Rescue Service, get ready for plug-in electric vehicles as well as the fuel cells. The consumer wants this technology. So the fuel cell, Chevy has their Equinox fuel cell vehicle, which is still a kind of a beta test. It's essentially an SUV that has the onboard systems. We're going to deal with vehicles that use hydrogen for propulsion and emit no emissions. But what a whole different vehicle it is. It doesn't fuel up with gasoline. It fuels up with hydrogen at a special hydrogen refueling station. So this is a reality that's not far away from us anymore, and we're going to have to learn what to do. The hydrogen, through the Department of Energy, the hydrogen fuel cell industry that's developing these vehicles are doing a great job putting out some preliminary training and educational information, all going to be downloadable and available. But what a difference it'll be to respond to the vehicle that has hydrogen tanks stored on it and is generating its own electricity through this reaction. What a long way we've come from the days of just the gasoline car. For example, I mentioned that Chevy Equinox, the fuel cell vehicle. They have it figured out on that particular vehicle that there's going to be a hood switch. And if you unlatch the hood, it would actually shut off the flow of hydrogen from the compressed storage cylinders in the back of the vehicle. So if the hood's open while the vehicle's running, the high voltage current is disabled and the flow of hydrogen through the fuel cell system shuts down. Well, wouldn't you like to know that? If you get to a vehicle in the future, a year from now, 2 years from now, and it's your fuel cell hydrogen fuel cell vehicle, I would like to know that that's a pretty cool little thing. I wish all the manufacturers would do that. What is going to happen quicker, though, Bob, is on my number two here, is the plug-in electric vehicle, not a hybrid. Chevy Volt will be the first one. It'll be introduced in November. It's a four-door, four-seater, all-electric vehicle. And the way it's being designed, it's a hatchback. Four doors, four kind of bucket seats. The batteries, it's a 400-pound, 360-volt battery shaped like a letter T. And it will actually be in the center area of the vehicle. It'll go along the center tunnel area and then across the back seat area under the floorboards. It's a 400-pound lithium-ion battery. And here's what they're saying. I could buy a Volt all electric drive. If I drive to work in the morning, turn around and drive home, and that total trip is less than 40 miles, when I get home, I could get out a special extension cord and plug the Volt in my garage, plug it into my wall outlet, 110 or 220, and it would recharge the battery. I could use this Volt to commute to work 40 miles round trip and never use gasoline, ever. Now, to make extended range, what they came up with, it's called the Volt is called an extended range plug-in electric vehicle. They actually put an electric generator on board. On board, there's a 100-horsepower generator and 8 gallons of gasoline. So if you go more than 40 miles before you can plug it in, the generator kicks in, generates electricity to charge the battery, and the car continues to run. But this will be our first all-electric. It does not drive on gasoline. It does not fill up with gasoline to drive the vehicle. The little 8-gallon gas tank is to fuel the generator, onboard generator, that generates electricity. Chevy GM, Chevy Volt, they are going to do a big responder safety rollout. There will be video, there'll be PowerPoints, there'll be all kinds of responder guide information. They really want the responder community to be aware of this vehicle. So between now and the rollout of the first Volt, which is expected to be around November of 2010, it'll be the 2011 Chevy Volt, we should be seeing a lot of safety and responder-oriented information from General Motors. Now, right behind them is Nissan. Nissan, building in the United States, is saying we're gonna build an all-electric car. It'll be our 2011. It'll have only plug-in, no gasoline generator, no gas tank on board for the generator. It will have a 100-mile range before you have to plug it in to recharge it. And there's two other manufacturers are saying probably by 2012, we'll have an all-electric vehicle. Basically a four-door electric golf cart, if you want to consider it that. A four-door vehicle will be available in 2012 that'll go 300 miles before you would have to plug it in to recharge it. So as a fire rescue service, we need to start looking for, we're right at the verge of the introduction of electric vehicles. We haven't had them before, and now they will be a reality. 10,000 Chevy Volt starting in November, and then Nissan Leaf starting right after the first of the year will be the first all-electric vehicles to hit the streets here in the U.S.
So it's kind of an exciting time as well. We're seeing some innovations that as young kids we would look in Popular Mechanic and maybe see the conceptual versions of these vehicles that are today driving up and down the highway or soon to be driving on the highway.
It will be a reality, yes, sir.
It's, technology has really been an interesting aspect of our lives in the emergency service fields. One of the other things we hear conversation on amongst extrication folks and our members of the departments is many of these electric vehicles don't give us the signals that a combustion engine will, the loud rumbling and the exhaust and that. So going back to our safety component, knowing what type of vehicle it is, it could be as if it was silent and running at the same time. Are there any special things the department should do to be more aware of that potential?
In the challenge of a silent vehicle that goes into sleep mode, the challenge first came out with the gasoline electric hybrids, like the Prius and the Insight and stuff like that. It also is continuing with these two new all-electrics. What I can tell you is as soon as you get on scene and you identify that it is a gasoline electric hybrid or an EV, electric vehicle, turn the ignition off. No matter what it may be sounding like, don't trust it. It can be completely silent, but be fully energized and ready to drive away. So turn the ignition off. That is a consistent standard across all of these different vehicles. When you turn the ignition off, it instantly powers down the high voltage system, which is what drives the drive wheels. So take away the ignition and you'll take away the threat of this vehicle from going away. Now, both gasoline electric hybrids, called HEV, hybrid electric vehicles, and EVs, the electric vehicles, they both have two electrical systems. So what we're used to already on hybrids and what we're going to see come out on the electric vehicles is there will also be a 12-volt electrical system that we'll need to deal with as well. So on both hybrids and electrics, not only do you shut down the high voltage by turning the ignition off, you will have to locate the 12-volt and either disconnect or double cut the cables to shut down its second electrical system.
So we're seeing this once again, going back up through the list, tying into each of the previous nine components we've talked about and how no one stands alone at all times that we can always take a component of one, reference it back, and there again, go into our vehicle safety data systems and sheets. This is another one of those good-to-know items that may be part of it.
So here you flip down the sun visor. The car has a VSDS sticker on it, and it tells you, as a matter of fact, the high voltage battery's here, the 12-volt battery's here, here's where the fuel tank is or isn't. It all ties together.
Excellent.
They just need to listen to me. That's all.
Hopefully they're going to listen to this and the other conversations you've had with them. And maybe next year when we're sitting here, we'll be talking about the innovation that just became an industry standard.
What progress we've made.
And, you know, what more can we ask for? That would probably be one of the more enjoyable sessions. Now that we've hit the number one item on your list, advanced steel structural metals. The vehicles aren't made like they were when we were kids. You know, a can opener could pretty much handle most vehicles back in the day.
Well, literally, we did. We did a hammer and a lawnmower blade to cut them open.
Yep.
So now, ultra-high strength, low alloy steels. It's typically just called advanced steels. This made my number one list this year. What has happened is in 2012 model cars, they have to meet an increased crash resistance, side and roof. Two different standards have been increased. So the way the manufacturers are doing it is they're using the advanced steels. Boron, you'll hear guys talk about boron. You'll hear them talk about martensite. There's other kinds of it, but it's all advanced steels. Typically in the roof rail, A-pillar, roof rail, B-pillar, maybe all along the rocker. The whole side ring of the vehicle is turning into this advanced steel. So it took me a year, and I worked with State Farm. They donated new vehicles that had the boron in it, and the American Iron and Steel Institute sent me some steel engineers, and as I would get a car donated from State Farm for this research project, the steel engineers would tell me where the exotic metals are, the advanced steels, and I went tool by tool, brand by brand, style by style, and tested air chisels, reciprocating saws, power cutters, and the like. And what we found out is as the manufacturers are phasing in the use of this steel, ramping up for the 2012 when the cars are pretty much across the board going to have it, what we found is the advanced steels are 8 times stronger than the mild steels that we're used to. So the steel that, if your rescue team has a hydraulic cutter for your system, and you guys bought that cutter back in the 80s, that'll cut mild steel. It will not cut this boron or the martensite. If you bought a cutter in the 1990s, it won't cut this new advanced high-strength steels. What I found is, in my research, there is no electric reciprocating saw blade. There is no reciprocating saw blade capable of cutting the boron. There is no air chisel. The steel is so tough, as I tried to cut it with air chisels, I broke the tooth off the chisel bits. The only cutters that we had, the only tools we had other than hydraulic cutters that would go through this, oxyacetylene cutting torch and a K12. And they're not practical for this application. So then in my research with these new vehicles, I brought in all the different hydraulic tool companies and told them what I wanted them to do. They brought the equipment, sent in their representatives, and we systematically field tested hydraulic cutters. And what I found is, at that time, we started in the fall of 2008. Not all rescue tool manufacturers have power cutters that would cut through this stuff. They even relatively new tools purchased, say, in the last 5 years, the cutters were outgunned by the strength of this new alloy steel. What I found is many of the manufacturers have retooled, redesigned, and produced capable cutters that'll go through the advanced steel. And as they started to show up and we tested them, and in fact they actually cut through the stuff just like they're intended, I found out that the blade, first of all, the cutters were maybe 18 months old or newer. It was just the last generation of cutters. The blades were thick. The body of the tool was big and solid, and they slam a lot of fluid into it to try to outgun this steel. Because the cutters that you've used for years in your fire department that have done it, never had a problem, I can almost guarantee you, you're going to be stumped. You're going to be shut down and not able to cut any of the structural areas of these vehicles that have the boron or the martensite steel. The end result of my research, it took a year. The end result of my research was I came up with techniques called workarounds. Workaround techniques that if I went tonight and had a late model car, let's say a 2009. Oh, here's one. A 2009 Dodge Caliber. Now, that's like a $13,000 car, four-door car. It's plain Jane, nothing special. It's loaded with hot stamp boron. So you arrive at this simple extrication, got hit broadside, you want to cut the B-pillar and lay this thing down, and your tool just loads up and shuts down. What I came up with, part five of the series, is workarounds. I came up with ways to use existing equipment that we have and work around the challenge of cutting the steel when I couldn't actually cut it. So, for example, the B-pillar got pushed in on your patient, use the ram and push the pillar back. I came up with some new techniques as well as some old ones. So in the five-part series, University of Extrication articles, five-part series that explains all of this advanced steel, number five talked about these workarounds. I think you should click on the link, get those five articles, study particularly the whole series, but study part five and start training your guys now on workarounds techniques. The reality is you're probably going to have to spend $5,000 and get yourself a new hydraulic cutter. And it's going to have to come from one of the brands and one of the manufacturers that can say for sure that their tool is capable of cutting through this advanced steel. It showed up in cars as early as 2007. As they're phasing it in to get ready for the standard that goes into effect with the 2012 model year. And it's not the exotics. It's going to be every vehicle across the board. So that's my number one right now, getting the word out that we are going to be outgunned by the new steel. It's going to make a difference. It's going to make the car safer and more crashworthy. But when it fails, we're going to have our work literally cut out for us trying to get through it.
And you know, looking at this, it's going to have multiple impacts. First, every good operator should have a plan A, B, and C, so that when A fails, you go to B. But if you have that C in place, it gives you functionality. You're not working without an alternate plan, and a good leader will have the next one evolving as they stand there. Traditionally, our number one plan is to get the cutters out. But by utilizing information in your series at the University of Extrication with the workarounds, there's an excellent opportunity before you even hit the street for a department and a team of extrication folks to have that plan B already in place. And because it's so involved and it's very new to almost all of us as far as what we're faced with, I think we're going to really increase our operational profile by taking the time to train off-site, both classroom and with vehicles. And then next, it's also part of that justification when we're working with tight budgets across the country, across the world. Everybody has less money now to do more than they did a short time ago. When we're justifying the expenditures to our city halls, our community groups, or whoever is your funding source from where you come from, this is the type of information that if you're going to be well prepared to argue your point for dollars, this is the type of information. I think it's right at click of a mouse. They can go right into firehouse.com, bring up your series, get this information, and use it as a tool to validate your argument. We're going for a need, not a want. Yep. I know what
must have.
And exactly, you're taking it to the next level.
In our city, in City McKinney, Texas, we have 8 power rescue systems in our city, and I was able this year to fund 1 power cutter that is capable of going through this stuff. Now, maybe next year I can add another one or whatever. It isn't a nice to have. It's a must have. I had a training officer from New Jersey say, well, Ron, I understand how you're talking about these workaround techniques, but how do I train the guys on it? Because the cars I'm getting are just junk cars. I take spray paint. I take bright orange spray paint, open the doors, and I'll spray paint the side, the A pillar, along the edge of the roof rail, down the B pillar, across the rocker panel. And when the guys show up for training, I'll say, okay, now when you rotate over to that car with the pink or the orange paint on it, all that's boron. And we don't have a cutter capable of doing it. You guys, when you rotate to that car in training, you'll have to pretend it's a new car, and you'll have to do workarounds. So you can use a little instructor creativity to take an old vintage vehicle and make it a boron car for practice.
And good guidance. You know, I think the points we've hit on, all 10 brought something special to the table. From my own view on the topics today, this number one item, the advanced steels, opened my eyes to many different challenges we're going to be faced with. And it's definitely been enjoyable talking on them. As we start to wrap things up today, Ron, any just closing thoughts you have, both on today's top 10 list or just in the extrication world in general, you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, I want to be part of the solution to my number 8, the sources of information. If anybody listening has questions or has problems or needs more information, if there's a way I can help steer them, I'll be willing to work with them. Rmoore at firehouse.com, Rmoore at firehouse.com. Let me know if there's something that you need, something that you're having questions with or problems with, because it keeps me plugged into what's going on as well. I want to be part of the solution to help. So if there's anything said today that you need further follow-up on. The other point would be, now that the torch is passed to the trainers that have listened to this, to now make this information available to those in your agency, in your department, in your squad. So let's now take those of us that understand this and realize, and let's start spreading and letting everyone realize that these challenges are out there. That to me, it's sharing the information. We're gonna work through these. These are right now my top 10. Every year it might shuffle the deck, but these are the ones that we really need to be all together, up on, ready to go. So spread the word, keep in touch, send me information or ask me questions, and I'll do anything I can to help in any way.
You know, Ron, I want to thank you for joining me today. It was very both informative and very enjoyable to share the time with you. Hopefully our listeners will gain a lot out of this. And as Ron already hit on, you can find him monthly in Firehouse Magazine. Enjoy reading his articles. Cut them out. He's even gone to the point of giving little dots on the page so it's designed to be removed. I mean, he's thinking forward for us, kind of triggering your thought process, as well as definitely spend as much time as you can at firehouse.com, both in Ron's University of Extrication, where he moderates and keeps it up to date and is constantly adding new information for us. So, Ron, thanks again. It's been a great session. This is your host, Bob Dumel, for the Buzz on Technical Rescue. Thank you for listening, and have a safe day.
For professional sharps protection in all extrications, visit extricationwrap.com. Protecto Wrap Company's Extrication Wrap protects rescue professionals from sharp metal edges, broken glass, sharp plastic, and other wreckage hazards. The Extrication Wrap's easy peel-and-stick application saves time and lives in all weather conditions, including rain, snow, and extreme cold. For more details, visit extricationwrap.com.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.